I wanted to bring Ralph Nader into the conversation, the consumer advocate, many time presidential candidate. Welcome, Ralph Nader.
Thank you very much, Peter and Tony.
It's a privilege to have you with us, Ralph. As we talk about the importance of independent media, I wanted to read the beginning of an article you wrote recently entitled Sensationalist Media Missed the Mark. It begins like this: March Madness comes once a year. Media madness is year-round. What the mass media choose to cover and feature try to turn the priorities of any sane society upside down. Elaborate a bit on that, Ralph Nader, if you would.
Well, just look at the news and look at the mainstream media and what is not covered. For example, you think a big story would be the contrast when all the attention is being paid to $1 trillion worth of outstanding student loans, more than credit card loans, that there would be a comparison and an analysis as to why students have to pay anywhere from 3.5% to 9% interest, but big banks can draw billions of dollars of borrowings from the Federal Reserve virtually free of interest. So it's these kinds of contrasts that are almost never made by the mass media. We're in a corporate crime wave. There should be news stories every day on the corporate crime wave. Instead, they focus on a few sensationalized street-level crimes day after day after day, because the latter don't involve challenging their advertisers. Talk radio, dominated overwhelmingly by the right wing, commercial talk radio, you know, Rush Limbaugh and Hannity and so forth. And what do they focus on? They whitewash the corporations that are paying them millions of dollars a year. They are on corporate welfare, using the public airways free for profit. And they're always attacking any potential of government to help people. But they never attack the reality of government bailing out, subsidizing, and otherwise deregulating and not enforcing the law against corporate crooks.
Ralph Nader, you've been at it and on it for so long. You're beginning from exposing General Motors. You've had to go up against big companies. I was wondering if you could talk about your history of activism and what role Pacifica has played in that.
Well, whenever we want to put something out that has almost never been covered and that challenges the power structure, the most likely outlet are the Pacifica radio stations in New York, Washington, Houston, San Francisco, or Berkeley, etc., L.A. And it's really amazing to watch. Public radio takes a long time. They are highly self-censored, and the motivation for it is just look at it. Look at all the 15-second ads they put one company after another funding public radio, including Monsanto and Walmart and banks, etc. And that's supposed to be a freer of commercial restraint media, public radio. You can't get on public radio. Progressive leaders cannot get on public radio. Diane Rehm, forget it. Terry Gross, forget it. Charlie Rose, twice, forget it. Ashbrook up in Boston, forget it. Just look and see whether Bob Guenther or Jim Hightower or Bill Greider or any of the grassroots progressive leaders in the locality where the public radio stations are, see if they get on. The right wing gets on far more because they're afraid of the right wing. Public radio knows the right wing can stir it up in Congress. They can shave off some of the corporate donations. And so they cater to the right wing. And Pacifica is only what's left.
Could you give us a little bit of your involvement over the years with Pacifica Radio? And I'm sure you've had a great deal of involvement with the stations.
Yes. Well, one is they're really the only radio network, and as you know, folks, it's all nonprofit, a lot of volunteers, the only radio network that was accessible to us when I was running for president on the Green Party and then independent in 2004 with Peter Camejo, and then in 2008 with Matt Gonzalez. And, I mean, you just try and run a third-party or independent presidential campaign and try to get on the mass media. You're shut out by the Washington Post, by the New York Times, by NBC, ABC, CBS. In 2000, the three networks and CNN gave our entire campaign, our entire presidential campaign for the Green Party, 3.5 minutes from Labor Day in 2000 all the way to Election Day, a total of 3.5 minutes, and that included the questions by the interviewer. 3.5 minutes. And we were polling 5, 6, 7, 8%. And, of course, the criticism of the Presidential Debate Commission, that was first over Pacifica. The issue of Palestinian rights, you think public radio led with that? That was led by Pacifica. That was a big taboo. The subject of corporate crime, Russell Mokyber, editor of Corporate Crime Reporter, that was first on Pacifica Radio. And now, as you know, the archives, and I was listening to Pacifica Radio in Berkeley, they have huge archives. They go back where all kinds of people, Cesar Chavez and Paul Ehrlich and a lot of other leaders, Gloria Steinem and a lot of other leaders in the 60s and 70s, they got their first access to Pacifica Radio. And that's why all you folks need to support it. And if you listen to it, you should support it, because it will support you. You're not doing them any favors. You're doing us, the audience, a favor.
That's the voice of Ralph Nader. This is the LSB show. We have WPFW Local Station Board Chair Tony Norman here. I'm a LSB member, Pete Tucker, myself. Ralph Nader, I wanted to ask you your thoughts on the Occupy movement.
The Occupy movement put inequality on the front table. The mass media couldn't ignore it, because it's one thing having a three-hour march in Washington ignored by the mass media. But, you know, when you stay 24 hours a day in a public encampment, they can't ignore it. So they developed a new tactic, which worked. They developed skills in nonviolent open civil disobedience, which this young generation has not had much experience with. They put the issue of inequality. The 99% is one of the great progressive slogans of American history. And it resonated. And the reason why it was so great, not only it's accurate, because the top 1% own financial wealth equivalent to the bottom 95%, by the way. Not only is it pretty accurate, but it overcame the kind of sectarian divisions within the movement, which always engage in internecine fighting for space, for time, for attention. If they said, look, put that aside, we're all in the same boat here, and let's go. And it suddenly went into over 100 encampments all over the country. It was down to towns with 12,000 people, like Niles, Michigan. And it brought a lot of young people into civic action, taught them about what the police are like, good and bad, taught them about what their civil rights are like, taught them about free speech that's very controversial and how it's protected. It brought out artists. It brought out ingenious medical and legal aid assistance in the encampment. So it was very good. Now, having said that, it got cold, the winter came, the police evicted. Now the question is, what's the second stage? And what's going on all over the country, obviously, are small-scale events to stop home foreclosures and in banks, Wells Fargo the other day and the West Coast. But that's not enough. And what we're trying to convince the Occupy people of, this is a big issue that they can win this year, is a minimum wage, federal minimum wage of $10 an hour. It's now $7.25. It is ridiculous. It is far less than what the minimum wage was in 1968, when the productivity of workers was about half of what it is today. And so my motto is, to the members of Congress who've got to pass it, is, why are you against catching up with 1968? Get it up to 10 bucks, increase consumer demand, give some dollars to poor families who are trying to make ends meet. This money will be spent. It will not be hoarded. It comes in at about 70% in the polls. There's a lot of conservative workers will support it. You get a conservative worker in Walmart making 8 bucks an hour. You think that person's going to say, no, 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 I don't want 10 bucks an hour because I'm conservative. They're underpaid. They're not getting their just desserts. It's a winner. You can put the pressure on Congress. It reflects the decentralized nature of the Occupy movement. They can encircle the congressional offices of the senator and representative back home. They can get good media. It's an easy lead for reporters. It used to be the dynamic of the Democratic Party. You got to wake up the Democratic Party on this. Even Santorum and Romney are on the record as being for a minimum wage that keeps up with inflation. That'll break the 100% grip over the Republicans in the House and Senate by McConnell and Boehner, so they won't be able to obstruct it the way they have others. Obama is, in 2008, was on the record for $9.50 federal by 2011. The main scholar who disproved that it will cost jobs is now Obama's chief economic advisor, Alan Krieger, chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors in the White House. I mean, it's a winner in every conceivable manner. You get 200 groups immediately signing on, La Raza, NAACP, even the lumbering AFL-CIO down by the White House will start putting real resources in, I have been informed, including national television. And so why aren't they doing it? Well, I've talked to over 200 people in the Occupy around the country. They just don't organize themselves. They've got to connect with themselves and get it underway because they're the only ones that can provide the oomph at in public around congressional offices back home. And if they win this, let me tell you something. They'll be 100 times more influential because there are 30 million workers between $7.25 or less illegally and $10. I mean, there's some workers who aren't even paid the minimum wage. Oh, and $10. 30 million workers around the country. Real people who will, you know, take their hats off, roll up their sleeves, and join the Occupy movement. So if you can reach them through Pacifica, it'll be one of Pacifica's greatest accomplishments. I'm not going to say it's easy to organize the Occupy movement. We know how individualistic and self-reliant they are. But it's just like the old senior father with his sons. You remember that fable when he had a bunch of sticks and he wanted to, on his deathbed, he wanted to tell his sons they had to stick together. And he picked one stick and he broke it apart. And then he says, here are six sticks, six sons. It's an ancient biblical fable. He says, here are six sticks. Put them together. See if any of you can break them. None of them can break them. So it's time for Occupy to organize around the federal minimum wage. My website, nader.org, has my article with all the arguments, 1, 2, 3, and it also has an open letter to Richard Trumka, head of the AFL-CIO, telling him it's not enough for the AFL-CIO with its 13 million workers to be on the record. You got to be on the ramparts.